This one, those who are lacking challenge, I believe. We said first do no harm. Designing a model of trauma-informed care for survivors of human trafficking. And this is going to be presented by Anne Frechenbacher. And Anne comes to us from UCLA, that's University of California, Los Angeles. And her expertise or her interest is in labor, exploitation and migration. And thank you.
Hi, my name is Annie Fehrenbacher, and I'm a doctoral student at the UCLA School of Public Health. And this presentation is based on some work that I've been doing at the Saban Free Clinic Human Trafficking Program in Los Angeles with one of our co-presenters who unfortunately couldn't be here today. Her name is Dr. Susie Baldwin. And she runs a primary care clinic twice a month for survivors of human trafficking in LA. And this presentation is focused on our clinic experiences, some lessons learned through the process. I have no disclosures. So first I'm going to just give a little background on the learning objectives and then on trafficking generally and in Los Angeles specifically. I'll let you know about the key players and then some of the health consequences that have been documented in the literature as well as observed in our clinic. And then the real meat of the presentation is four case studies from our patients that demonstrate some of the key challenges that service providers face in the clinical setting. And then finally, I'm going to outline some of the basic tenets of trauma-informed care as we have conceptualized them. So the objectives are to identify barriers to providing comprehensive health care to trafficking survivors, to explain the unique challenges faced by health professionals working with trafficked persons, to describe how clinical settings can promote healing or lead to re-traumatization, and to explain the basic tenets of trauma-informed care. So in 1995, the Department of Industrial Relations in California raided a compound in El Monte, which is right outside of Los Angeles, and inside they found 72 Thai garment workers who were working for less than $2 a day, approximately 17 hours a day. And this was one of the first events that galvanized the modern anti-trafficking movement in the United States as well as internationally. And in 2000, the U.S. passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which outlined benefits that people certified as victims of trafficking could receive, which include temporary visas as well as assistance with food and housing, many of the benefits that refugees or asylum seekers would also receive. And the same year, the United Nations passed the Palermo Protocol, which outlined the first internationally agreed upon definition of human trafficking. So trafficking has three main elements. This isn't the full definition because it's quite long in the convention, but the main elements are first, the movement of peoples, which can take a number of forms, including recruitment, transportation, transfer, harboring, or receipt of persons. The second element is by means of threat or force, fraud, or coercion, which again can take a number of forms. And then finally, for purposes of exploitation. And this happens in a range of trades. Most of the work has been done on sex trafficking, but it's also quite common in other labor industries, such as garment industries, agriculture. We see a lot of domestic workers in our clinic, people who are maids and nannies for individual families. And then there's also trafficking of human organs. So in 1997, after the El Monte case broke, a group of local activists in Los Angeles formed together to aid the Thai workers. And this led to the formation of the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, which is a human rights organization that focuses exclusively on direct service to trafficked persons. And it was the first one in the United States. And it was also the first organization to open a shelter specifically for trafficked persons, which right now houses 9 women as well as 2 children. And in 2003, the Venice Family Clinic partnered with CAST, the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, to form a primary care clinic because CAST only provides social services, case management, and legal services. And in order to fill that gap, they partnered with a community clinic, and it was originally part of a refugee trauma clinic, as well as a clinic focused for torture victims. But eventually it moved to Saban, which is in Hollywood. It's a little more central in Los Angeles and closer to where most of our patients live. And I wanted to mention a little history on the original clinic. It was founded by a doctor. His name is Dr. Quiroga, and he was the personal physician for Salvador Allende before the coup in Chile, and he himself was a victim of torture. So has a lot of personal experience that can relate to the patients. But again, we moved towards downtown to accommodate our patients, and also realizing that trafficked persons are not exactly the same population as torture victims or as refugees. And then the third player is a new group. I'm one of the co-founders, and so is Jennifer Mustu, who was one of our co-presenters, who also couldn't be here today. And we founded in 2009 to bring attention to scholarly work around trafficking in university settings. And then in 2010, we started piloting a health literacy program at the CASH shelter. And Kit, who is filling in for Dr. Baldwin, is also presenting a poster on some of our work at the shelter on Wednesday. So if you're interested in that work, you can attend the student assembly session on Wednesday. So to give you some background on our patients, you can see that it's an extremely diverse group, both in terms of age, place of origin, language, and form of trafficking. Most of our patients are women, but we do see quite a few men, and this is something that's underdocumented in the literature. It's often assumed that women and children are more vulnerable to being trafficked, but more and more the data is showing that's not the case. It's because we've been focusing exclusively on sex trafficking and overlooking cases in industries such as agriculture and other forms of forced labor. You can see that we have patients that speak a number of languages. Many of our patients do speak very basic English, but it should be noted that in a clinical setting, this can be quite complicated, even if you do have functional literacy and language ability in English. It still can be quite complicated to understand clinical instructions. So I'm not going to get too much into the health consequences because Kit will cover that in her presentation. But I just wanted to kind of highlight the intersection between mental and physical health. And one of our main focuses in the clinic is to look at psychosomatic representations of trauma. So often our patients will have symptoms such as phantom pain or incessant headaches when there's really no physical basis that we can identify and diagnose. And very little research has been done on the connection between trauma and mental and physical health for trafficked persons. There was a recent study that just came out this year by Kathy Zimmerman and her team at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. But again, it was focused only on sex trafficking victims, and so we still don't know if it applies to all populations of trafficked persons. So what is trauma? I've just put up two definitions that are widely used in the mental health field, but there are many others, and what I wanted to highlight is sort of a shift that's happened over the years in the definition of trauma, when originally it was seen as more of a characteristic of an event, that there were inherently traumatic events, whereas now we see trauma as both an exposure to a traumatic stressor as well as an individual reaction to that. So now we have more of a subjective understanding of trauma. And this is very important in our clinic because not everyone conceptualizes their experience as traumatizing. And it also makes it quite difficult for us to determine what a model of trauma-informed care looks like. So our first case study, I should mention that all of the women's names and countries of origin are not mentioned for confidentiality reasons. So we see a patient regularly who is a young woman from Africa who was trafficked for domestic servitude. And she is a particularly unusual case, and it's kind of easier to objectively see that this experience is quite traumatizing. Not only did she experience human trafficking, she also experienced a great deal of violence before going into domestic work. She witnessed the murder of her husband and was blamed by his family for this. She had also experienced FGM as a child, and her daughter was subjected to this as well against her will during the time that she was trafficked in another country. And she eventually got out of the situation when the family that she was working for traveled to Los Angeles, and she met a co-ethnic in a hotel who referred her to CAST, and she got out of the situation that way. But she still has many recurring issues related to her trafficking experience, as well as the violence she experienced earlier in her life. And one day during the clinic, she arrives 5 minutes late, and she's curtly told by the receptionist that she won't be able to be seen until the next patient comes. The next patient doesn't show up, and she's still waiting for over an hour after she's already taken the bus for 3 hours to get to her appointment. And during this time, we come out to the front desk and we hear gunshots in the background, and we see that the movie Avatar is playing in the waiting room. And it's something that might seem kind of benign on the surface, but the idea is that we need to take into account that many of our patients have traumatic experiences in their past that are not documented in their medical records. And this is one thing where it was just sort of careless work on the part of the clinical staff to not take this into account. We have a woman that we see regularly who is from an Asian country. She was trafficked to the U.S. to work in an elder care facility along with many other people from her country. This was a case, though, where there was actually a police raid, and people were referred to CAST through legal channels. And this patient, during a follow-up appointment with Dr. Baldwin, mentions something about her current job. And Dr. Baldwin says, "Well, how long has it been since you've been paid?" And she says, "Oh, I've never been paid. I've been working for the family for 2 years, and I've never been paid." And part of this case that was quite interesting is that our patient didn't necessarily feel this was something wrong. She didn't necessarily think that it was similar to her previous experience. But we see many patients who are in something that looks like trafficking again, more exploitative working conditions. And often they don't know the labor laws that are available to protect them in the U.S. And so part of what we do is not just clinical service, but also social interaction, as well as providing legal and labor guidance as well. Okay, Irina is a 30-year-old woman from Europe who was trafficked for commercial sex work. And during an appointment, Dr. Baldwin asks how her current method of birth control is going, and she's using Depo-Provera, which is a hormonal method by injection, and it lasts for 3 months. And she mentions, "Oh, it's not good for me. I've been bleeding all the time." And Dr. Baldwin explains that, you know, this is quite a common side effect you may be spotting. And but she can tell that the patient is still distressed by this, and so she asks a little bit more about it. "Why is it bothering you?" And she says, "Well, I haven't been able to go to church because I'm always bleeding and I can't go to church within 7 days of my period." So this is a case that kind of demonstrates that there are many cultural and religious values related to experiences that we might see as quite normal in the U.S. or from a medical perspective. But this conception of spotting was a new idea for her. And we had to take into account that her socialization through her church was a very important part of her recovery. So not only did we have to find an effective method of birth control for her, we also had to find something that fit with her lifestyle and with her values. And finally, our patient Maria was a 40-year-old deaf woman trafficked from Latin America into the United States. And when we were waiting for her at an appointment, and it gets quite late, so Dr. Baldwin goes out to the front desk to see whether she was told about her appointment, because this often happens in a safety net clinic that people are not notified of their follow-up appointments. And we go up, and the receptionist says, "Oh, we left her a voicemail." But unfortunately, Maria is deaf, so she can't listen to voicemails. And there's supposed to be a note in her chart that says that she needs to be notified by text about her appointments. So again, it's a very simple thing that seems like it should be easy to accommodate for patients, but often these things are overlooked in the charts or never get between the doctor's office and the front desk. And finally, she does arrive, but there's no sign language interpreter on staff. And Maria is illiterate, so she can't read. We can't communicate through writing. So what we end up doing is using her partner, who is also deaf, to interpret. And the process goes that Dr. Baldwin asks a question, she writes it down and shows it to Kathy, and then Kathy signs it to Maria, gets her response, signs it back, and then writes it down as best she can, and shows it to Dr. Baldwin. And that is the process of interacting in a lot of our cases. And part of it is just, it's not only a language barrier, it's also a literacy barrier. And in safety net settings where clinics are often understaffed, you have to come up with creative ways to accommodate patients when you might not have a trained interpreter. So what is trauma-informed care? Trauma-informed care takes into account how an experience might affect a person's conception of their health as well as their health-seeking behaviors. And we're trying to create an environment in the clinic setting where every aspect of the management, training, and service delivery is assessed to make sure that we understand why it is that people might present in ways that seem sort of atypical, particularly because of what I mentioned, that many people have physical manifestations of trauma that are hard to diagnose. So some of the basic tenets that we've outlined, and we've been in the process of trying to turn into a training for the staff at Zavon, are taken from Kathy Zimmerman's team in London. She worked on a guide for the WHO on interviewing trafficked women for research purposes. And it's not quite the same setting as a clinic, but we found that there were a lot of parallels that we could draw from. They're quite important in our setting as well. So first is to adequately select and train interpreters and clinical staff. And again, this is not always possible in the settings where we're delivering these services, as I said, especially in economic crisis as we're in right now. But part of this can just be having the service provider keep an eye on interactions with the rest of the staff, because many of our patients never make it back to the doctor's office because there's so many other people that they interact with along the way. And a case like Desta's that I mentioned, if she has a bad experience at the front desk, we may never see her for her appointment. And often our patients don't return if they have an experience like this, which can have a very big impact on the trajectory of their care and their recovery. We also have been working extensively to prepare referral information in advance, because as I mentioned, we are a free clinic and we can't provide most of the specialty care in the clinic on the day of the appointment, and so often we have to refer them out to other public hospitals or private services if it's necessary. And again, many people either aren't notified of their appointments or don't know how to navigate the system when they get there. And we have to be prepared to provide emergency intervention when necessary. And these also seem like basic tenets you should have in every clinical setting, but it's particularly important with this population. A, because they're assimilating to life in the U.S., they're facing many of the issues that all immigrants face in coming here. But they also have some medical history that's quite unusual in most cases. And of course, to assure confidentiality. And then some tenets that we've outlined for patient-provider interaction. The first one, which is very important, is not to ask unnecessary questions. So as I said, we're a primary care clinic, and often it's not important for us to know what happened to them during their trafficking experience. People come in for routine care, for annuals, for physicals, for job clearance, and it's just not important for us to know what may have happened during the time when they were trafficked. And in other cases, it might be related to their current health condition and how they're expressing what they're going through, but it's important to note that as providers, we're not entitled to know that unless it's necessary for their care. And the second one, as well as related, is to listen to and respect each patient's assessment of their own health and to use their language. So when I say use their language, I don't just mean the language that they're speaking linguistically. I also mean the type of language that they use to describe their health. So, for example, in Irina's case, if she says, well, this is how I interpret what's happening to me, I'm going through a constant period and I can't go to church, it's important for us to acknowledge her own way of conceptualizing this issue and to see it through her terms, in that often our medical language is not comprehensible for our patients, and it's also not helpful in many cases. So we try not only to accommodate the language barriers that we face, but also to try to interact in a way that kind of meets them where they are. And then finally, don't make promises you can't keep. And this refers to a lot of what I was mentioning about referring out for specialty care, or if someone has a chronic illness or something where there's not a clear path to how they're going to recover, it's not helpful for us to say it's just going to get better, or you're going to have access to something that they may not be able to get. So we try to be quite guarded when we make assurances to our patients and only tell them stuff that we know that we can fulfill in the clinical setting. And then finally, we just wanted to make a note about vicarious trauma, which is that this is a very challenging field of work, and it can be quite traumatizing for the service provider as well to hear stories that are very unusual and often very violent. And so it's important for service providers also to take care of their own health and to monitor how their interactions with patients are affecting their personal lives. Because it's hard to care for your patients if you're not caring for yourself. So just in closing, I wanted to mention that, again, this is a new form of care that we want to change from the front desk to discharge, so every element in the clinical setting is assessed. And again, I just wanted to emphasize that this isn't just about doctors, it's also about pharmacy staff, it's about medical assistants, it's about everyone that patient interacts with the moment they come into the door. And ideally, in an ideal world, we would like to see this outside of the clinical setting as well. And just wanted to emphasize that this is something important for all patients and not specifically for immigrants, refugees, and trafficked persons. Thank you.